Love and Light. This is Healthy Talk Show for Sunday, March 10th, 2019. I'm Robert.
And I'm Marissa.
Healthy Talk Show is a live weekly discussion of various topics relating to health. We stream live on Sundays at 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. That's 2300 UTC over at healthytalkshow.com/live, with podcast versions available soon after over at healthytalkshow.com/subscribe. Subscribing is 100% free, and it makes sure you get every episode as they're released, and it helps us out somehow. I don't know how. The internet thinks it's cool. HealthyTalkShow.com/support if you'd like to support the show financially using PayPal or Patreon. Value for value. If we provide you value, please provide some back in whatever form you feel. And yes, feedback is valuable. Rate us on iTunes, email us, call us, leave us a voicemail, 509-878-3229. Ask HealthyTalkShow.com. HealthyTalkShow.com/YouTube. Show notes for this episode with all of the sources that we cite, all the links, everything, HealthyTalkShow.com/HTS11 for 11, because it's our 11th episode.
Woo.
Whoop. What's up? What are we doing? Got a good show today.
Yeah, we got a jam-packed show.
Yeah, we're questioning some very new and MMR vaccine research that everyone's posting about, but no one actually opened up and read. You know, they didn't read it. They just reposted it. So, oh, yep.
Good to go. Science is in.
Got a lot of Facebook news, a whole lot of that. Facebook news. A lot of Facebook news from all different aspects. It's really weird. And daylight savings, which is why we're tired.
I know. And why it feels like the day just went by before we even got to do the show.
I know. Well, first headline. CNET. Volkswagen debuts a pair of weird electric scooters in Geneva. The German automaker explores alternative transportation with zero-emission streetmate and city skater urban mobility concepts. We like these because they look really cool. And I have pictures of them. Let me show you some. They're kind of blurry. Don't know why. But that's just the way they are. Look at that. That's a small one. There's a smaller one. Yeah. Kind of cool looking, though.
That one's cool looking.
I like them. I like the way they look. They look cool. But are they practical? That's, you know, I don't know. But the next web. No, scooters are not a good replacement for public transportation. This was funny.
A little contradictory.
Yep. While each scooter pulls in around $2.32 net revenue each day, the scooters have an unfathomably short lifespan and must be replaced after less than a month's service. Open data from Louisville gives the average electric scooter an average life expectancy between 28 and 32 days. Scooters were touted as the thing that will eliminate short car journeys. Instead, we got the world's fastest pipeline to scrap heap. Along with all environmental concerns electronic waste brings.
Wow.
Yep.
And we've just been talking about our last episode about waste, so.
Yeah, and these are just, they're just dumping these scooters with these batteries. And just, does anyone remember the hoverboards a few years ago that were blowing up?
Vaguely, yeah.
Yeah. What's the difference between these and those? Remember where they had to lock regulation on them and no one's allowed to purchase them because of the batteries were unstable and they were catching on fire and. I don't understand how these are just being dropped everywhere.
Yeah.
It's kind of, yeah. All this article also brought up ride-sharing services. As more people take up driving as a career or side gig, the number of cars on the street soar. According to a 28 study by transportation expert Bruce Schaller, whoever that guy is, app-based taxi platforms have caused city driving to increase by 160%, having impact on both congestion and air quality.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah, and then the article mentioned something pretty interesting. The annoying thing is we know how to get cars off the road, and they say it's fare free public transport. And it's been around since 1971, which I don't necessarily disagree with. It works.
It's true.
Where we're at in Riverside, we can take the bus all the way to Disneyland for $1.50 or something.
Yeah,
$2.
People just usually don't take the bus.
Yeah, which is bothersome.
Plus, what are some of the other concerns with e-scooters?
Well, good segue. CNBC. The CDC is studying the rise in e-scooter injuries for the first time as startups expand to more cities.
Ooh.
And then the Washington Post, closely related. Hospital ER reports 161% spike in visits involving electric scooters. Woo!
Wow.
couple of takeaways. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention has launched this first ever study of electric scooter accidents at the request of Austin Public Health and the Austin Transportation Department. So far, data has shown many accidents don't involve other vehicles, and most rider-involved accidents weren't wearing helmets at the time. Oh, yeah, most riders involved in accidents were not wearing
helmets. Aren't you supposed to wear helmets?
That's
at least
interesting.
Allegedly, that's what you agreed to.
E-scooter companies like Byrne and Lime say they support the study. That's, and they go into a few smaller studies done by San Diego, just by, like, you know, taking hospital stats and whatnot. And it's mostly related to people not wearing helmets, people falling and not wearing protection. But how can you wear helmets? The point of these is that they're available everywhere. You're supposed to carry a helmet with you everywhere?
Apparently. I had some interesting quotes, though, from some of these doctors that probably started the inquiry.
Okay.
So they're saying in San Francisco, the doctor who runs the emergency room at a major hospital studies is seeing as many as 10 severe injuries a week. And then it's interesting that you mention how they're ending up in trash heaps, because critics add that some electric scooter fleets are poorly maintained by a loose-knit flock of amateur mechanics, making them prone to dangerous mechanical failures. So it's all kind of related.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Wear a helmet. On those things, you should be wearing a helmet. They go really fast. And yes, you should always wear protection in the chat. Got a chat room question. Should I always wear protection? Yes.
Yes.
You should.
Protect. Protect your brain. Protect everything.
Protect your head.
Yes.
What did I say? CNN, the world's top 100 most polluted cities in 2018. Does anyone have any guesses? Who dominated?
I have a guess.
Who dominated? Come on. Anyone have a guess? Guess? Well, Asia has dominated a new list. This new list, where's it at? Right here. So, let's see. Well, here's the list. If you want to see just everybody.
Yeah.
Oof.
Is that up at the top, Bangladesh?
Yeah. Unhealthy.
Bangladesh, Pakistan, oof, India.
Jeez Louise.
You know, that wasn't surprising to me, because they are starting to become more industrialized, and then they're burning more coal as the demands for electricity grow in India. So they're really booming right now.
Yeah, but they're not.
Well, they're burning the cheapest source of energy, which is coal.
Booming with no control, yeah.
Which is then kind of raises questions for the United States, where if we're trying to go to this zero carbon, does it really matter if India's burning tons of coal?
Hey, you got to do your part.
Yeah, we just put at a huge disadvantage then economically.
Yeah, we are. And then, yeah.
But, you know, we all got to work together, develop all technologies.
Hold hands, love,
light. Nuclear. HealthyDoctor.com.
Oh, no. Daily Mail and Mashable both picked up this story. Millennials lead the mass Facebook exodus. More than 15 million users in the U.S. have quit the site in the last 2 years over privacy concerns. And this is what it says. It's not, I don't even want to, this story. It's because there's only 1,500 users, so, but people are running with it like it's,
yeah,
like it's fact, and it really bothers them, but it's not, so don't worry about it. Facebook's doing okay.
I found that interesting. Well, I think the issue, too, is there's a lot of metrics of how do you measure engagement, how do you measure whether people are posting. So I have this graph over on my screen for a second.
Yours is better.
So this one, it still claims that the number of monthly active Facebook users worldwide has been growing. So you can see the steady growth. I think some concerns that there isn't as much engagement on Facebook as there used to be, or people aren't posting as much as they have these privacy concerns, and maybe they no longer want to upload all their photos up.
Yeah.
There's this other stat. They're saying that Facebook just dropped to the third most visited website. So according to both Alexa and SimilarWeb, YouTube just replaced Facebook as a second most popular.
Which,
you know, again, how do you measure these stats?
Yeah, they says they had 2.32 billion active users fourth quarter 2018. So that's a lot of freaking users. That's a lot of users.
But people are saying that the younger crowd is leaving Facebook.
Yeah, and going to Instagram.
Right. And then the older generation, they're still on Facebook. And
yeah. Well, I have a news flash for everybody.
What?
Facebook owns Instagram. It's the same thing. You're not getting away from anything.
It's true. It's just that Instagram layout is way sexier.
Yeah, well, much less complicated.
Yeah.
Less reading.
Less comments, less triggering. Thinking. People like pictures.
Yeah, they do. So are they hurting? I don't know. They're losing users. You know they are. But are they hurting yet? Well, we are actually talking about them today. So I guess we can get into a BBC documentary that came out a while ago about it's the worst job and no one cares. Let me cue this up here. Video takes me a second. It's just the way it is. Nature of the beast.
It's the most important job in Facebook, and it's the worst, and no one cares about it. Every day you will see things that shock you, traumatizing stuff. Beheadings, child pornography, animal abuse.
Viewing the photographs.
You become like
it.
A machine. With this hand, the next button, and this button, yes or no. So you click, next, decide, next, decide.
What was the worst kind of content you had to see?
I would definitely go with child pornography, because you get to see, like, even a six-month-old baby being raped. Also terrorism. You see very graphic images of blood and terrorist attacks.
Okay, so what this is these are the content moderators employed by Facebook specifically, but there are other companies that, of course. So all these AIs and these algorithms that you think are helping the situation, that's usually just people.
Yeah, which I was really shocked about, because they make it sound like artificial intelligence is doing all this and machine learning, blah, blah, blah. It's the algos.
Yeah, it's
but
not.
It's really people.
It's people looking, and they're looking at some nasty stuff, because people are trying to upload nasty stuff to these platforms all the time. It's really. All right, next clip from the documentary.
This work is hard, but I will say that the graphic content, that sort of content, is a small fraction.
And she's Monica Bickert, head of product policy at Facebook, by the way, the lady talking.
Of what reviewers might see. Increasingly, we've been able to use technology to review and remove some of the worst content that you might see somebody upload to Facebook.
Okay, see, now she's
a little contradictory.
Yeah, but you have the, okay, let's check this out. Support for the employees. Let's see how they're being supported.
Did you think of the way the company supported you and supported your colleagues?
The company didn't support us at all. I think we complained almost every day. Almost every day, because we had problems. We didn't like the things we were looking at.
We know it's difficult. We're committed to giving them what they need to do this job well. And if they're ever uncomfortable at work, there are counseling resources for them, and they can be shifted to work on a different type of content. It's important to us to keep our community safe, but it's also very important to us to support our employees and keep them healthy.
Question in the chat. So these are people that are paid to be the content moderators?
So yeah,
anytime that someone reports an inappropriate picture, then it gets flagged and it goes to these people. And they're actually contractors.
Yeah, so, these are contractors through Facebook.
Yes.
They hire independent firms to view this content as a moderation until they get posted to watch for, you know, terrorist beheading videos, child porn, all kinds of stuff that nobody wants to see. And these people are being exposed to it.
Yeah, that's true, that they do opt to do the job.
Yeah, they opt to take a job that pays crap.
Yeah, so some stats, these moderators, for example, this company in Phoenix, Cognizant, they're paying their employees $28,800 per year, while the average Facebook employee makes $240,000.
Yeah.
So I think part of their unhappiness stems from the fact that they're playing such a huge role in this Facebook moderation by being the labor, but yet they're not being compensated very well.
Someone in the chat, I opt to do a shitty job. Yeah, well.
Yeah.
I couldn't do this job.
Oh, and
especially not for $30,000 a year. You better.
And they're complaining as well that Facebook employees get treated really well, while these contractors, every break is kind of micromanaged. There's a quote here from the Verge article that says, two Muslim employees were ordered to stop praying during their 9 minutes per day of allotted wellness time. So that's also kind of unfortunate.
Yeah, and from this Verge article, which is called The Trauma Floor, The Secret Lives of Facebook Moderators in America, it also say employees are developing PTSD-like symptoms after they leave the company, but are no longer eligible for support from Facebook or Cognizant. How do you say it?
Cognizant.
If a platform requires the abuse of its work members to expose themselves, perhaps the real issue is the support of the bad platform to begin with, not the content exposure. Well, so should Facebook just shut down?
Yeah. Well, I guess that's kind of the problem that the internet is facing, is if people are free to upload, you know, whatever videos, you know, how do you then solve this issue? And the problem is Twitter, Facebook, they're all under enormous pressure to stop this immediately.
Yeah, we're actually going to talk about that later in the show. Let's get back on track here. Correct?
Yeah. Well, all right. Is there more clips?
Nope. But now we can go into the actual Verge article, because the Verge, like we were citing from it. Yeah, that's true. NSFW filters are filled. Okay, VergeCast, just to clarify, because this was in the UK a few months ago, this movie, this little documentary, but now Verge is reporting on it now because it's coming out and all over the place. I think Austin, Texas. But they actually did something on their podcast. I want to give them some props because a lot of people are not talking about this. Let's play this clip from their podcast, 38 seconds, The Verge Cast.
Sort of asked, like, what is the job? The job is to work an 8-hour shift where you're going to be asked to look at maybe 300, maybe 400, if you're really moving quickly, posts per day, and then spending less than 30 seconds on each item, decide whether it adheres to Facebook's very lengthy community guidelines. And as the story points out, those guidelines are actually changing almost every day.
So the job is you fire up this tool called Single Review Tool. It just shows you something on Facebook somebody reported, and you click yes or no based on what you know of Facebook's guidelines.
That's right.
And again, they're always changing.
Yeah.
So you're basically playing Tinder 300 to 400 posts a day.
Yeah, that's insane.
And you have to... And they actually have a point system, which we didn't want to clip from the podcast. Go listen to the podcast. We linked to it.
Yeah.
It's actually kind of hard to find, but we found it.
It's definitely a good
point. It's a point system, because if you flag something for something that's a lesser point, then they'll ding you and say, well, you actually should have flagged it for terrorism, not for the nip slip.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. It's freaking nuts.
And they're expected to get 95% accuracy.
Yeah. So. Which is...
And then...
These are people making very little money doing this. They're being exposed to this. And now we go into the science behind this, correct?
Yeah.
Administration for Children and Families, what is secondary traumatic stress? Do you have that?
Well, I have the Verge article first.
Oh, Verge article.
I just wanted to pull that employees are developing PTSD-like symptoms after they leave the company.
Yeah, I said that.
And so this leads us into the Psychology Today article.
Yep.
Or we have repetitive viewing of violent news stories can increase fear and anxiety in viewers and can even cause people to have increased health issues. Viewing of disasters on television, particularly terrorism, can increase cases of PTSD, depression, anxiety, perceived stress, and even substance abuse. And of course, what's the solution? Stop watching these images. So
that's a great solution.
Yeah.
So.
And like Robert mentioned, this causes secondary traumatic stress, even though you weren't actually the ones, you know, being subjected to these horrible either beheadings or rapes. You still become traumatized.
And we took a lot of out of the BBC clip, but the woman in the clip goes, or go the document or whatever it's called, a little docu clip giblet. She goes into her dreams and how she had some pretty messed up dreams. I just don't want to play them because it's not really.
It was just her experience.
Yeah, it's her experience, and it sounded pretty bad.
Yeah.
It's not something I'd want to dream about.
But it's definitely something that we wanted to bring awareness to, that there are people behind these AI filtering mechanisms, or however they spin it towards the public.
All these companies have these people in place.
All right.
And
keeping on the subject of Facebook.
TechCrunch. Facebook won't let you opt out of its phone number lookup setting. I gotta find this. I'm sorry. We skipped ahead so much.
Yeah.
We skipped ahead so much.
Oh, this is interesting because I know this is how I always stalk people.
There we go.
Back yeah. when I was dating.
Yep. Huh. Users are complaining that the phone number that Facebook hassled them to use to secure their account two-factor authentication has also been associated with their profile, which anyone can use to look up their profile. Worse, Facebook doesn't give you an option to opt out. What? Last year, Facebook was forced to admit that after months of pestering its users to switch on two-factor by signing up their phone number, it was also using those phone numbers to target users with ads.
Wow.
But some users are finding out just now that Facebook's default setting allows everyone, with or without an account, to look up the user profile based off the same phone number.
These are more ways that Facebook is in hot water with its users.
My goodness gracious. Facebook, when will you stop? When will you stop? Probably never.
Yeah.
They're so, probably going to put themselves out of business.
So, of course, now they have to pretend to care about privacy.
Yep. Well, actually, The Verge. Sorry, The Verge.
Oh, yeah. Yep. I forgot about this.
Some major Android apps are still sending data directly to Facebook. And we actually talked about this. Even when you're not logged in or don't have a Facebook account, major Android mobile apps from companies including Yelp and Duolingo send data that could be used to personally identify you for ad tracking straight to Facebook immediately upon logging in, according to a report based in the London, UK charity watchdog group Privacy International. We talked about this many episodes ago, but apparently it's still going on. So, but this is interesting. As revealed by the Wall Street Journal last month, a number of prominent iOS app iOS app makers use a Facebook analytics tool known as Custom App Events that, in this case, was sharing sensitive health, fitness, and financial data with the social network for ad targeting purposes.
Oh, man. All about that. Those ads. Facebook can't stop.
Hey, thanks for the follow, Random Info. Appreciate it.
So then...
CNET. This is a small story, not really anything to get alarmed with. It's just funny because it's just piling onto Facebook. I think it's hilarious. Facebook Messenger bug revealed who you had conversations with and just the browser flaw. Let potential attackers figure out who DMs you slid into through some... I don't even know if it's worth it. It's not even worth it.
It's just funny.
It's just hilarious.
It's just more ways that they can target, figure out who you're hanging out with,
and
advertise.
Yep. It's just funny. Oop, I lost that tab.
Thank you, Random Info. We try to do all our research.
Yeah, we try really hard. All right. Here we go. Switching gears, but still in Facebook mode. The Verge. Read Mark Zuckerberg's letter on Facebook's privacy-focused future. Quote from the letter, I believe the future of communication will increasingly shift to private encrypted services. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg just published a lengthy post outlining what he describes as privacy-focused future for his company's various messaging platforms. Facebook Messenger, Instagram, and WhatsApp, and online communication at large. Zuckerberg admits that some of these important changes could be several years away, but the ideas he's promoting will be seen by some as a paradigm shift for a company that has always prioritized connecting people publicly.
Yeah.
And then CNET picked up something similar. Facebook expects encrypted messaging to outpace the news feed. In Gadget, Facebook only cares about privacy because it has to, and that's more to what you were saying earlier, Marissa.
Yeah. Plus, I think it's interesting, too, that they're kind of jumping on the encryption bandwagon. We've talked about Signal and Skype being encrypted, and now Facebook is kind of trying to catch up.
And the Next Web actually dug into that a little bit more on the surface.
Yeah.
They broke it down. Mark Zuckerberg plans to make Facebook more private with 6 key changes. Messaging comes first. Encrypt all things, and that goes back to what you were saying about encryption. Zuckerberg says people expect their private communications to be secure and to only be seen by the people they've sent them to, not hackers, criminals, overreaching governments, or even the people operating the services they use. At the same time, encryption makes it... He didn't say this. I'm not quoting anymore. At the same time, encryption makes it difficult to catch bad people doing bad things, so the company is exploring ways to detect patterns of activity to use other means to catch bad actors, even with encryption.
I find this really ironic that they're trying to go encrypted when the whole time they've been monitoring our messages.
Yeah, just sell your information. They can't switch the model.
Now the backpedal. No one's going to trust them.
Well, A, they have to make money somehow. They make money by selling data. You can't collect data if you have true end-to-end encryption, because end-to-end encryption is I'm one end, you're the other end. Facebook can't see what we're doing. They can't do it. I don't believe it. A great free and secure true end-to-end encryption program that runs on both Android and iOS is called Signal. We use it and love it. It's endorsed by Edward Snowden. Check it out, signal.org. It's the best.
Signal is great.
Number 3 from this next web list. Make posts disappear after a given time. That's been controversial. I don't quite... Make apps work with one another. Good luck. Don't bow to countries with a record on human rights. Okay. Have an open conversation about the future of social media. What do you think?
I think Facebook, they're really trying to save themselves now, but it's probably too little too late.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
They are trying really hard. I give them, they're an outdated, now that people are starting to become aware of what they're doing with the services. It goes back to 10 or 15 years ago when everyone was really excited about targeted ads. I remember I was listening to tech podcasts back in the day. Everyone's saying targeted ads are the best of the best. Well, guess what? Guess how you get targeted ads? You have to be spied on. People have to know what you're doing and where you're at and why you're doing. They have to know all these things about you to target the ads. So guess what? The targeted ads are the reason. We have to go back and say, well, maybe we don't want targeted ads.
Or
I'm cool with the survey. I'll do a survey.
That's true. And I think, too, when people first thought of targeted ads, you were going to find new restaurants in your area. And then it became, let's stock your browser history so we can try to predict all these other products that you're interested in. And it just got out of control then.
Yeah. As one of our chatters said, I'm not going to buy the product anyway. Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you. They don't even work. All this spying doesn't work. All right, CNET, switching gears away from Facebook for a minute. Your landlord turns your apartment into a smart home. Now what? Locked out on the first day. New privacy worries. It's the upgrade many tenants didn't ask for. Landlords are jumping on the smart home bandwagon. The market is expected to reach $53 billion by 2022. And a 2018 survey by Entrata, a real estate software management company, showed that a majority of renters wanted smart home features over amenities like on-site childcare. I'd like to see that survey, but it doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me. In most states, landlords are required to give notice to tenants before entering your home. But with data collection, landlords have a constant virtual presence in these homes. For the convenience that all IoT devices provide, connected devices introduce risk, including potential hacks. Already, families have been terrorized by a hacked Nest Cam blaring alarms, while a Nest thermostat was hijacked to thrust temperatures up to 90 degrees.
Yikes.
And while 1 in 4 households intend to buy a smart lock this year, security researchers have consistently found vulnerabilities with locks that could allow intruders to break in.
So,
what do you think?
I read the article, but then what was kind of the conclusion? Because I felt like once your landlord installed this, you really didn't have a choice but to leave unless you're okay with this.
Yeah.
I mean, they mentioned how the smart lock company, joined his Wi-Fi without his permission, and then he later kicked them off. But that still didn't address how he had a smart lock. And it also doesn't address how are these apartments keeping your information safe.
They're not.
Well, precisely. And then what do you do, though? That was...
It's the future of apartments.
But they had this clickbaity title of now what, but then there never was an answer.
Oh, that's true. There is no what now what. Yeah. Basically, yeah, that's true. Because you have to use these devices. You have to take the upgrade. We had friends that actually had to move out because their landlord was pushing smart home upgrades. They said, no, we don't want a smart lock on our apartment. So they had to move out.
Yeah, I mean, these are crazy privacy concerns. What if people hack the apartment once they know, especially this whole apartment is probably run by this company. They can hack all the locks potentially.
Yeah.
There are lots of videos on YouTube.
Oh, it's really easy.
Yeah. They tell you how to bust these locks.
Horribly.
You have no choice but to use them or move out.
Do you remember when we toured that rental, that house with the cameras, and only the landlord had access to the cameras? Do you remember that?
I don't.
It was a big house.
Oh, yeah.
A bunch of cute girls living there.
Yeah, that was really creepy.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. That was really, now thinking about it, because there were really cute girls living there. That's even, whoa.
I mean, it's just unfortunate that you just can't be private in your own home.
Yeah.
And then not to mention it's tracking who's coming, who's going.
You can't make the decision anymore. I make the decision. Well, currently we do. We're renters too, but we make the decision not to put these smart devices in our house.
Yeah.
But technically we don't have a decision. If the landlord wants to come in and say, guess what, you're getting this smart device, you're getting this Nest thermostat, well, I'll make sure it malfunctions every time. The Wi-Fi, I don't know what's up with the Wi-Fi. It won't connect to the Wi-Fi. There's too many VPNs and firewalls. I don't know what's going on. It won't go into the Wi-Fi. It won't go on. That's what I'll say.
Yeah, we have an interesting comment from the chat. So this entire subject causes me to question our own ability to consume technology. I do see the advantages of these things. I do not think we're in a state to handle them responsibly. If our use exposes others to harm, perhaps we should simply not do the thing until we are capable of no harm. That's a good philosophy. A lot of the times we rush to kind of implement all these cool news.
Just because we can.
Yeah, precisely.
That's the problem.
And we never stop to think about
ramifications, yeah. Waste, anything like that. And this is not an anti-vaccine stream or anything. This is a pro-science stream.
Yeah.
We have a professional scientist and a professional hippie. Thank you for joining. Now let's get into some vaccine talk. How about that? I love it. I love the vaccine conversation. Let's do it. New York Times, what really makes a difference in vaccination rates? Social media platforms play a role in spreading misinformation, but state legislators have the power of law. Social media companies face increasing scrutiny for amplifying fringe anti-vaccine sentiment amid measles outbreaks in several states like Washington. In response, Facebook, YouTube, and Pinterest. Why Pinterest? Recently made headlines by announcing initiatives to reduce vaccine information on their platforms. And I don't know, because we had that study a few weeks back where it showed that actually social media was not the one pushing the anti-vaccinating stuff the most.
Yeah, and it said availability of clinics was actually the biggest reason why people weren't vaccinating on schedule.
Weird.
Plus, it's true. We the people are the ones that allegedly elect these representatives to put into law what we want, and yet we write laws with a lot of exceptions and loopholes.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you guys don't want any exceptions and you got to make it into law.
Well, because nobody actually reads the laws.
Yeah. And again, right now I'm not arguing for or against. I'm just saying
you're just talking about law.
Write the laws to reflect what you want it to do.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And not have loopholes.
Yeah.
Because that's how people.
No loopholes. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. That is one of the greatest compliments we can get. Thank you so much. We really appreciate it. We don't get enough of that. We really appreciate it. Thank you so much. People don't love us. Oh, man.
So then continuing on.
Remember, we're scientists here. In the next web, Facebook and Instagram will hide pages that spread vaccine misinformation. This article, interesting. Let me read to you how it opens. Very condescending. I'd like to think that everyone who reads the next web, TNW actually, knows that vaccines work, that they don't cause autism as demonstrated time and time again, that autism doesn't need the extra stigma and is most certainly preferred to sick and dead kids, that vaccines keep everyone safer, not just the vaccinated. That's kind of, come on. Yeah, it's you know there are people questioning that on the internet, but why would you write that? You're just trying to stir the fire. Come on, I don't understand. Facebook will begin reducing the ranking in both groups and pages that spread misinformation about vaccines in newsfeed and search. If a page meets the misinformation criteria, it won't even show up in the predictions when you begin typing a search, stopping people on clicking out of sheer curiosity. It won't show or recommend such content in Instagram Explorer or hashtag pages. The company will also reject ads with misinformation about vaccines, as well as remove related targeting options like vaccine controversies, which is interesting. Well, they try to expand their ads. You know, that's something you could put your ad. That's an ad category. It's interesting.
Yeah, that's true.
If an account is a multiple offender, it might be disabled altogether.
Wow.
Ooh, man. And then continuing on, who else do we got? Wired. Facebook will crack down on anti-vaccine content. The only reason why I picked this one is because of this. Oopsie, I did not mean to click that crap. Here we go. Last month, Adam Schiff, a Democratic representative from California, sent letters to the CEOs of YouTube and Facebook demanding they answer questions about the spread of anti-vaccine information on their company's platforms. Pretty good, because we covered that. I just like to say we covered that.
That's true. We've been watching this.
He followed up with a similar letter to Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos last week. On Wednesday, the 18-year-old who sent it from Ohio. Ohio. I didn't realize it was from Ohio. Who testified about vaccines and stuff. Did you read about that? I'm sure everybody read about that. I really hope everybody read about that. Anyways, moving on. In Gadget, Facebook will make anti-vaccine content less visible. Now, I actually have from the Facebook newsroom by Monica Bickert, VP of Global Policy Management for Facebook, how they're going to implement this. We are working to tackle vaccine misinformation on Facebook by reducing its distribution, providing people with, what is that? Authoritative information? On the topic, we are starting by taking a series of steps. We will reduce the ranking of groups and pages that spread misinformation about vaccines in news feeds and search. These groups and pages will not be included in recommendations or in predictions when you type into search. When we find ads that include misinformation about vaccines, we will reject them. We will also remove related targeting options like vaccine controversies. For ad accounts that continue to violate our policy, we may take further action. Perfect. We won't show or recommend content that contains misinformation about vaccines on Instagram or Explore. Perfect. Okay. And then we are exploring ways to share educational information about vaccines if people come across misinformation on that topic. Fair enough. Okay.
Didn't we see that on YouTube too with how they're sharing the Wikipedia pages for anti-vaxxers and
YouTube.
Or yes. Talking about vaccines.
Yep. And then to get specific, they actually say leading global health organizations such as World Health Organization and U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have publicly identified verifiable vaccine hoaxes. If these vaccine hoaxes appear on Facebook, we will take action against them. If that's, you know, that's a little bit more official than Facebook saying that we're going to make the decisions ourselves. At least they're basing it on something outside of that.
Yeah, but I still don't know how far we're going. You know, what's a vaccine hoax?
Yeah, that's... Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's a slippery slope of censorship. So
yeah. And actually, now we're getting into Joe Rogan had Tim Pool, Jack Dorsey, CEO of Twitter, and Vijaya Gadde, global lead for legal policy and trust and safety at Twitter. She was cool. Very well-spoken. Legal background. She was chopping block.
Yeah,
really
she was
good.
Very
she
good.
Got she was good. And they were talking about the platform censorship, like actually platform censoring content and why certain users have been banned. The context of this clip is in regards to YouTube going after anti-vaccine content, as we're talking about with Facebook and all these companies are just filtering out this content. What her logic is pretty sound. So, yeah, let's listen to it.
To that statement you made about misinformation and whether or not you'll police it. So I think
that the tough part of this is really, and love to have a discussion about this, is do you really want corporations to police what's true and not true?
Absolutely not.
That's a really...
That's in a nutshell. Do you really want corporations policing what's true and not true?
Yeah.
That's dangerous.
And the problem is the corporation always has an agenda. They usually have to answer to advertisers. They have their own bias. It's just really, I don't know. You can't ask corporations to do that.
Yeah, because they have to make money. All right, now we're diving into something. I'll read how it's been being displayed. Science Daily, no link found between MMR vaccine and autism, even among children with other risk factors for autism. Summary, a nationwide cohort study of children born in Denmark and two Danish-born mothers between 1999 and 2010 concluded that the mumps, measles, and rubella MMR vaccine does not increase the risk of autism, does not trigger autism in susceptible children, and is not associated with the clustering of autism cases following vaccination. Very interesting. New York Times, something similar. New York Times, one more time with big data. Measles vaccine doesn't cause autism. Right there. Big data. Where's that? Right there. A 10-year-old look at more than 600,000 children comes at a time when anti-vaccine suspicion is on the rise again. The researchers who followed Danish children, blah, 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 whatever. Okay, whew. All right. Finally, I'm so happy. The science is in.
It's solved.
Before we get into that, though, I want to read a comment from somebody on a social media platform about vaccines. And this is not in regards to this article, it's in regards to someone getting tetanus, I think, or something.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just going to read this. I'm not going to oust the person. It's just very condescending. I don't like this at all. This is bad. Some people should not be parents. I normally would not advise people on how to take care of their children, but this is one major exception. If your child has no health reasons preventing them from being vaccinated, vaccinate your damn child, in all caps. Hate speech. Children should not be subjugated to long-term effects of these illnesses and the potential fatal, all caps, effects of catching these preventable diseases simply because their parents are fucking morons that will listen to celebrities instead of actual educated professionals. Seriously, you're given a brain, so fucking use it, damn it. All right, well, let's listen to an educated professional talk about this study.
Well, wink. The problem with this study, so there's definitely a few issues with this study. So one of them being that they only studied white people.
And in Denmark.
Like Robert said, two Danish-born mothers, so not even immigrants. And so this is really interesting as well, because if we look at this JAMA article talking about the incidence of autism rates, so the study was done in 2018, and they found autism prevalence of 1.68% among children, and they're saying that maybe increasing rates to 2% or 2.47%. And if we look at their article, so we have to scroll down to find it.
Yep.
And I have it highlighted, but they found an incident of only 1% autism rate.
That's weird.
So that's already a little suspicious. And maybe they kind of cherry picked this data. So there it is, 1%. And they said, oh, it's similar. But you're still missing about 0.6%. So I don't quite trust this data. There's also just self-selection and how they divided it. So if you like had a sibling that had autism, they were trying to like categorize whether there was an increased risk, and it just really wasn't well done, in my opinion.
And it's just the MMR vaccine. A lot of people, I don't know why people run with stories. They just take it to the top. Some people are thinking that this just proves vaccines are safe across the board. And I say, no.
Yeah, so
it doesn't prove that.
We can also look at who did this study. So a study was funded by the Novo Nordisk Foundation.
Who's that?
So if we look at these Novo Holdings, they're the ones that are part of the Novo Nordisk Foundation, but they're involved in pharmaceuticals. They actually recently acquired Minervax, and they're trying to develop vaccines for streptococcal infections. It was also funded by the Staten Serum Institute in Denmark, and they're also involved in vaccine making, manufacturing. So they have an interest. So there's a little bit of conflict.
Financial
of
interest.
And then another interesting thing is if you look at some of the online complaints of why people say that, oh, well, my child received autism or got autism after they got both the DTaP vaccine and the MMR vaccine together. And this study didn't look at that. It only looked at the MMR. And if we also look at our vaccination suggested rates, so this is the American CDC rates. And so we have our first dose of vaccines at 2 months, 4 months, 6 months.
That's for the U.S.
And then we can compare that to the Denmark schedule. So they're a little bit more delayed than us. So 3 months, 5 months, 12 months. And then also then they give the MMR vaccine at 15 months. And our recommended MMR vaccine is at 12 months. So a little bit different.
Yeah.
And again, we're not looking at the two vaccines together. If you get both the DTaP and the MMR vaccine together, that wasn't studied. So science is not in.
Not in, unfortunately. It's a step. But that's interesting because a lot of the anti-vaccination crowd, whatever you want to call them, I don't know, the opposite, I don't know, whatever you want to call it, we got to come up with names for the group now, whatever it is, their arguments are at least vaccinating too early, vaccinating children way too early. They're big time against that. They say as soon as a child comes out of the womb, you should not be vaccinating the child. That is their big push. They are big to every, a lot of people I know personally are big time against that. They're not anti-vaccination, they just say let the child open the eyes, you know, and breathe a little bit before they start poking the child.
And I definitely agree with that. The spacing out of vaccines, people are saying that we should do that. Again, this is not about anti-vax. Yeah. This is about trying to figure out the safest way to administer these vaccines.
Yeah, keep researching. That's what they say. That's a long study, though. That was a long study.
Well, but
It's yeah.
It was also one of those meta studies where you look at data of data.
Yeah. So study of data.
We need more direct studies, but it's always hard to prove causation. And I think both sides are having issues with this.
Yeah.
Neither one can kind of prove, so we kind of argue back and forth.
Yeah, and they call each other names instead of just...
Yeah, instead of sitting
being
down...
Being scientist about it, let's just research and figure it out.
And let's research worldwide.
Yeah.
And all races.
Yeah, not just...
Not just Denmark.
Please. All right, well... Rounding off the vaccine discussion for this episode, last headline. Where is it at? Is that the headline that I wanted? I think it is. Yes, it is. Even CNN, even with the measles outbreaks across the U.S., at least 20 states have proposed anti-vaccination bills. Shouldn't the headline read at least 20 states have proposed anti-forced vaccination bills or anti-mandatory vaccination bills? Because just because they're okay, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics, at least 20 states have introduced bills this year that would broaden the reasons why parents can exempt kids from getting vaccines even if there isn't a medical need, to require doctors to provide more information on the risk of vaccines. Okay. That just seemed like a interesting... What did we get in the chat? Yeah, it's
kind of a weird headline.
Yeah.
Plus, it's what the people want, and that's how our society works.
Yeah,
so.
Well...
I'm just saying that's how we make laws.
Yeah, that's how laws work. That's how things.
But yeah, both sides are not really looking into the research, and everyone just kind of runs with a headline instead of slowing down to talk about things.
Talk about it.
All right, so moving on with other drugs.
Gizmodo. Ketamine is now an FDA-approved depression treatment, but who will be able to get it? And then a short blurb from this Gizmodo article. Since it was discovered in the 1960s, high doses of ketamine have been used as a sedative for animals and people. More infamously, in smaller doses, it can be used as a trance-inducing and hallucinogenic recreational drug with colorful nicknames like Special K or Vitamin K. But starting in the 2000s, researchers began finding evidence that very small doses of ketamine can also help people with depression and suicidal thoughts. And then the New York Times also ran with a story on this. New York Times, doctors welcome new depression drug cautiously. How do you say it? Esketamine?
Esketamine.
Esketamine, the nasal spray antidepressant recently approved by the FDA, is promising, but using it entails some practical challenges. Of course, because it's ketamine. And then Gizmodo rounded off. How is taking ketamine for depression different from falling into a K-hole? The doses of ketamine people are getting to treat their depression, though, are much smaller, according to Dennis Charney, dean of the Something School of Medicine at Mount, I don't know, and one of the first scientists to study ketamine's effects on depression. The dosage can depend from person to person in these clinics. And the same is true of someone taking it recreationally. But typically, we're talking about doses that are smaller by several fold in magnitude. So they're microdosing ketamine for depression.
Well, it was a little misleading, too, because I believe they're using the S-ketamine. So I don't know why they're saying it's ketamine.
Yeah, I know.
So, yeah, there's some confusion there. And so S-ketamine is a different isomer of ketamine, and it has a lower risk of side effects. But one of the quotes said, "That said, no one has seemingly compared the two versions directly, although at least one upcoming study plans to." And there's a lot of questions, too, because the dose of ketamine, sometimes you have to get close to what's called kind of like the K-hole effect, where you start getting the hallucinogenic effects for it to be an effective antidepressant.
Yeah.
So then there's a lot of questions about misuse. And we've been talking about previously, and we're actually going to talk about OxyContin more.
Yep.
And how that was kind of prescribed and it was eventually abused. So there's kind of this worry of, well,
what's going to happen with ketamine?
Yeah.
And we actually have a BBC video from 2015. YouTube, it's on YouTube, China's ketamine craze. Ready to roll into it?
Yeah.
We wanted to learn about ketamine because we didn't know too much about it. And this is interesting. Yeah, party time.
Nighttime in the southern Chinese city of Shenzhen. Those with money and energy to burn are out to play. With a secret camera, we recorded young men inhaling ketamine, a drug that's soaring in popularity here. Users say ketamine makes them feel like they can fly. but many can't handle the consequences. This rehabilitation clinic has seen a leap in the numbers struggling with ketamine.
Wow.
Yeah.
Again, we're learning about ketamine. Now here's a short 16-second.
Just 3 weeks before, this former police officer couldn't function without it.
The craving was really strong.
A police officer addicted to ketamine.
Every morning I wanted to snort ketamine. At night, the drug kept me up. It totally screwed up my life.
That's scary.
Yeah, so definitely worried about the potential for abuse. There was even a quote, too, that said, in trials, patients have reported disorientation, high blood pressure, and vomiting. And others taking ketamine for depression have also talked about feeling something like a euphoric trip. So again, even though they're using doses lower than we just witnessed in the video for partying,
mm-hmm.
they still might have some of these side effects.
Scary. Well, let's watch the conclusion of this video really quick. Where does it come from? I'm curious.
Many experience lasting damage to their brains and also their bladders. Some have had to have their bladders removed, a heavy price to pay. We wanted to know who was profiting.
Ketamine can be made almost anywhere, but there's one village in China that's notorious for making all kinds of narcotics, for sure.
This village made headlines when 3,000 paramilitary police swept Boshua, arresting 182 people. But the drug trade lives on, despite repeated raids. We wanted to see the village for ourselves, but it's a risky trip.
Oh yeah, and there's one more.
The land is polluted, littered with byproducts of drug production. Ketamine is technically difficult to make, but Chinese drug gangs cracked the code. Now, underground labs manufacture large batches of cheap ketamine. Meeting in an abandoned factory, this villager tells us the drug trade will continue in the shadows. He insists he's not involved in actually making drugs.
Yeah, right.
But many of his relatives have been arrested.
Drug prices are dropping because they are easier to make. Too many know how to manufacture them now.
Ketamine's becoming a significant illegal export. 60% of the world's ketamine seizures take place on the narrow boundary between mainland China and Hong Kong. Unless the Chinese authorities crack down on this drug, many worry it will spread even further beyond China's borders.
That's pretty scary.
Yeah.
If that's the same stuff. But we need to see some research now because it's not actually the same thing.
They're similar since.
They're similar. Yeah,
but
know.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye on this one.
Yep. HealthyTalkShow.com/support.
So.
Lando, stop barking.
Next to OxyContin.
Yep. Ars Technica, OxyContin pusher, Purdue, blames everyone but itself for opioid crisis. Illicit drugs and dealers are currently driving deaths, Purdue argues. In a motion to dismiss an explosive lawsuit brought by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, OxyContin maker Purdue Pharma argues that it is not responsible for the current epidemic of opioid overdoses, as the Commonwealth alleges. Even if people are now overdosing, were initially patients who became addicted to opioids while using the highly addictive painkiller, which is true. People, when their prescriptions run out, they go to the illegal black markets to get the drug.
Yeah.
That's the way that it works. That's the way addiction works. We actually have a short little interview here with, what the heck? Right. Why is it so long? Oh, crap, did I export it wrong? It's 2 minutes, it's a 2 minute long clip. We're going to play it, PBS NewsHour, we're playing it, going for it.
Has long told a story, which is essentially that the Sackler family, which owns the company, has a real arm's length.
Owns Purdue. Sackler family owns Purdue, the pharmaceutical company.
Relationship is not actually all that involved, And the Sacklers have developed this reputation as great patrons of the arts and universities who never really have to talk about the family business, which is the source of all their wealth. What's fascinating about this filing in Massachusetts is that you have hundreds of pages of documentation from inside the company showing very, very active involvement from multiple members of the family who are members of the board, but not members of the board who are at some distance, mm-hmm. members of the board who are very, very actively directing Purdue Pharma in pushing OxyContin even after this epic public health crisis that we're all experiencing now.
Give us an example.
Well, so Richard Sackler, who's really the most active of these various family members, who's the son of one of the founders of the company, one of the three brothers who originally took it over, would regularly be asking for sales reports. He would be coaching people on how they should go out and push OxyContin to doctors. When you started having people dying of overdoses, he is very involved in emails saying, look, the way we're going to spin this is that it's about drug addicts. These people are criminals. This is not our problem.
Blaming the victims. I know.
Blaming the victims, absolutely.
That's what they're doing.
And he really comes across in email after email after email in these various accounts as somebody who was almost obsessed with the sales of the drug, to a point where you get to a stage just a few years ago where sales of OxyContin start to level off. And there's an obvious reason for that, which is that doctors have woken up to the fact that this drug is killing people and opioids are killing people. We now have some 200,000 people who've died in opioid-related deaths in the last few decades. And so sales are leveling off, and this clearly drives him nuts. And he's saying, we need to keep pushing. We want bigger doses of the drug for longer periods of time, which is exactly what anybody who's looking at this soberly will tell you
yeah.
is a recipe for addiction and a dangerous state of affairs.
And so Richard Sackler wants to just keep pushing the drug, according to these court filings and emails. Wow.
And I think we've talked about it before, how they knew that it was addictive, and then they recommended that it be prescribed in these large doses, and that got people addicted.
We got a lot from the NewsHour.
First introduced the drug, very consciously set out to change the minds of doctors. The doctors up to that point had been reluctant to prescribe strong opioids for pain conditions that weren't sort of end of life, palliative care, cancer treatment.
They didn't even want this to be a prescription drug at one point, right?
Well, right. So you actually have a point where it was...
Listen to this.
...going to be a prescription drug here, but they were looking to expand internationally, and the Sacklers start wondering, well, could we have this be a non-controlled substance? So like aspirin, you walk into CVS,
yeah.
you
walk
into the counter. And there's a back
Hell
and forth
yeah.
in these documents between Richard Sackler and the inventor of OxyContin, the inventor of the drug, says, I think it would be pretty dangerous. That would be a bad idea. And Richard Sackler says, yeah, but what would it do to our bottom line? What would it do to the number of sales we can?
What would Whoa. It do to our bottom line? Arguing with the inventor.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Ugh, man. PBS Purdue crisis. How can we push it still?
And in the face of this knowledge, the Sackler family is still pushing and wondering, how can we get out there? How can we be selling more? Why are sales slowing down? And so they're fully aware of the crisis. They're fully aware of the huge, just astonishing human toll.
So these aren't emails from 10, 15 years ago. This is just in the last few years.
No, this is what was most striking. So in 2007, Purdue Pharma actually pled guilty to criminal charges of misbranding, essentially deceiving people about the dangers of the drug. Three executives pled guilty. The company paid a $600 million fine. And one of the big interesting questions has been, all right, well, if that was the turning point, was that when they kind of got wise? Was that when they realized, oh boy, okay, we may have transgressed a little bit in those early days, but now we know what's going on. And we now have this documentation showing that not just in 2008, 2009, but in 2016, 2017, when the country is reeling from this epidemic, inside Purdue Pharma, they're still thinking, how can we push this drug?
That's crazy.
That's just... Oh, thanks for the cheer.
Thank you.
Hey, 2017. Here's another long one. But we're trying to get into just the business practices of these companies because it doesn't quite come out too often.
Yeah.
So here's one we called Steak Dinners.
Also, documents in here, or I should say there were parts of the filing that included them trying to have an influence on both academia and hospitals. How did they do this?
Well, this has been part of the strategy for the company. I should say not just Purdue, but many companies. Purdue really has excelled at it, and the Sacklers have. in terms of, first of all, influencing doctors, all right? So there's all kinds of relationships they have with doctors. They realized early on that a doctor is more likely to prescribe a new drug if it's another doctor recommending it. I thought it was almost like putting an athlete on a box of Wheaties, right? Mm-hmm. You listen to the people you trust, your peers. So they started paying doctors. They, you know, funded research. So you get this crazy situation in which you're a physician and I'm a physician and I come to you to tell you about this new drug. I'm paid by the drug company. I show you a study that's been done about the drug, which was also paid for by the drug company. We have this conversation over an expensive steak dinner at a nice resort in Florida, and we're all, you know, getting sent there by the drug company. One of the statistics in this filing is that Purdue's budget just for food bought for physicians who prescribe opioids every year was $9 million a year.
What?
That's a lot of nice steak dinners. What?
That's a lot of money.
Yeah, that's...
One more.
There are dozens and dozens of lawsuits right now ongoing across the country. More than half of the states in the United States are suing Purdue Pharma. And so it's unclear where these are going to go. Some people think there will ultimately be a big settlement along the lines that there were with the tobacco companies back in the 1990s. I think the interesting thing for the Sackler family is that what this Massachusetts case has done is kind of pierced the corporate veil. It's no longer just Purdue Pharma and the Sacklers are somehow at a distance. Now the Sacklers have all been named, and it does seem that there may be some real liability on the parts of these individuals who were clearly directing the company. So if I were them, I'd be worried. I think you're going to see more lawsuits. You will ultimately see some sort of big settlement. And the really interesting case now is that for decades, part of the reason the Sacklers were able to kind of burnish their own reputation was by giving huge amounts of money to elite cultural institutions, to museums like the Guggenheim, to universities like Yale. So at what point do these institutions start saying no to that money and potentially taking the Sackler name off of their various institutes and buildings?
All right. Patrick Radden-Keefe of the New Yorker. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
New York Business Journal, hedge fund dumped Sackler family, owners of OxyContin maker. It hasn't been a good week for Sackler family, which controls Purdue Pharma, owners of OxyContin. I think I have a code. Yeah, cotton. Yeah, that's how you say it. Think. On Monday, it was reported that the company was considering filing for bankruptcy protection to contain liability from hundreds of lawsuits filed around the country alleging the company is partly responsible for the nation's deadly opioid crisis. Then on Thursday, the Wall Street Journal reported that the hedge fund Heldin Capital Management tossed the family from the fund, saying it was uncomfortable managing its money because someone close to the firm had suffered an opioid tragedy.
Oh, man.
What drugs do Purdue manufacture? Well, that's an interesting question. We pulled this up here. Let's take a look. What do we got?
Prescription, opioids, sleep aids, laxatives.
Where's the funny one?
They also, let's see.
Where's the one that's, there's they make something that's supposed to help you get off of opioid addiction.
Oh, MS Cotton?
Right here.
Oh, wait, no, that's, no, no. So they,
it's not it.
Yeah, but they also produce morphine.
There we go.
Oh, yeah. The Butrans, a partial opioid agonist drug that is most commonly used in the treatment of withdrawal from opiates. Awkward.
That's weird. That's kind of weird.
So they create a problem and then they
create the solution to the problem.
Yeah.
It's great. I love it. New York Times, good news. Opioid prescribing fail. The bad, pain patients suffer, doctors say. This is interesting. People don't think about this.
Yeah.
Doctors and insurers are using federal guidelines as a cover to turn away patients, experts tell the CDC and Congress. 3 years ago this month, as alarms about the overprescription of opioid painkillers were sounding across the country, the federal government issued course-correcting guidelines for primary care doctors. Prescriptions have fallen notably since then, and the Trump administration is pushing for them to drop by another third by 2021. But in a letter to be sent to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on Wednesday, more than 300 medical experts, including three former White House drug czars, contend that the guidelines are harming one group of vulnerable patients, those with severe chronic pain who may have been taking high doses of opioids years without becoming addicted. They say the guidelines are being used as a cover by insurers to deny reimbursement and by doctors to turn away patients. Yep.
Yeah. This is also a concern because what if they turn to illegal sources if they can't get their legal drugs?
And actually, I work with people that are a little bit older.
Yeah.
That are getting turned away for their pain pills.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. That's... They're not happy about it. They're getting turned away.
I'm sure. And I've definitely heard of people. I know some people that are chronically ill and they depend on these drugs and then they can't get them because people think that they're addicts.
But yeah. Which...
There's two sides to every story. But
yep.
This opioid crisis has been an issue.
New York Times. How to quit antidepressants. Very slowly, doctors say. Is that what they say?
That is what the study actually says.
Do you want me to go to your screen? Can I?
Yeah, we can.
Got.
So it was pretty interesting. They tried these antidepressant tapering strips to help people come off medication more safely. So if you look, this is kind of how like the dosage drops off in your body. And so they were kind of recommending these 4 weeks to get off the drugs, but actually you need a lot longer. And so they had these little tapering strips that allow people to more easily meter their dose and quit over months if they needed. And a lot of these people, they had been unsuccessful previously and they wished to discontinue. And then 71% succeeded in tapering their antidepressant medication completely. Some of the other things that the study said was perhaps these withdrawal symptoms prevented people from quitting their antidepressants that wanted to. So maybe they felt that it was time to stop taking their antidepressants. They stopped, had withdrawal symptoms, went back on them. So now if they can taper off more slowly, this might help more people get off these medications that have been on it for long-term usage.
Yeah. So. Sounds good.
So talk to your doctor.
Talk to your doctor. Yeah, with antidepressants.
Don't. Yes, definitely.
Ooh, don't just quit cold turkey.
Yeah, they were also saying this could be a way, because many people have issues when they're taking many antidepressant medications, and then they're trying to taper off. So if you could taper off all of them, and it kind of helps slowly lower the dosages, this could be really good and help people. Holy, that's cool.
It's good. You know, we've been talking a lot about vaccines, opioids, antidepressants. If it's legal, I would say follow the words of the great and late Rick James. You know, that's all I'm going to say. Hopefully, it'll get removed for that. Leafly, this is interesting.
So. On the subject of Mary Jane.
Yes. Uh-oh. California could run out of legal cannabis by summer.
Uh-oh.
The supply of legal cannabis in California promises to start drying up by spring unless a quick fix becomes law. On Tuesday, February 19th, the California legislature, which is a little old, published Senate Bill 67 to keep cannabis farms open as they await permanent licensing. Right now, thousands of farms operate under temporary licenses from the California Department of Food and Agriculture, CDFA. Those 6,924 temp licenses are expiring faster than the CDFA can issue permanent annual licenses. Those temp licenses also can't be extended unless existing law is tweaked. It's been 834 days since California voters approved cannabis legalization in November 2016. So far, the CDFA has issued just 9 annual cannabis farm licenses. Another 39 annual farm licenses are pending payment of fees as high as $44,000 per license.
Yikes.
Comment from the article. How typical. I'm from the government. I'm here to help. Not. It's an issue that doesn't need to exist. There's not a supply issue. There's a regulation issue.
Yeah, it's issue just here. Red tape
and yeah, it's red bureaucracy. Tape. So that's bullcrap. Don't take away the marijuana.
Otherwise, people are just going to go back to...
Black market.
Yeah, black market.
Black market. And in the chat, yeah, growers do make a lot of money. We could talk about that offline. I'm just being real. That's where the money's at. Wait, how did this pop up? What the fudge? Aw, man, why did this take me away from my story?
I don't know. That R. Kelly story keeps coming up.
Jesus.
Yeah, right, organic small batch cannabis.
Okay. Well, I have Science Daily and Daily Mail here, but I can only show Science Daily. Low-carb keto diets raise the risk of heart rhythm disorder, study finds. According to Daily Mail, Science Daily. Summary, low-carb diets are all the rage, but can cutting carbohydrates spell trouble for your heart? People getting a low proportion of their daily calories from carbohydrates such as grains, fruits, and starchy vegetables are significantly more likely to develop, how do you say that? Atrial fibrillation, IFib.
Atrial fibrillation.
Yeah, atrial fibrillation, there you go. The most common heart rhythm disorder, there you go.
Yeah, and so why they say that all the eating all these excess proteins may lead to oxidative stress, and so this basically also could increase your risk of other forms of cardiovascular disease. It's kind of funny. We saw this several years ago with the Atkins diet.
Yeah.
Where people are eating the low carb, high meat.
And now keto is
It's
back.
Essentially the same it's thing.
Very similar. Yeah.
So, you know, this wasn't good for you then. People were at risk for heart attacks.
It hasn't changed.
Yeah, you're eating a high-fat diet, so that's not good for you, especially in the long term. So it could lead to temporary weight loss, but...
We don't endorse the diet. HealthyTalkShow.com/support if you want to see some cooking segments and see the diet we endorse.
Yeah.
Science Daily, eating healthy on a limited budget is possible, researchers find. True. Summary, the affordability of health... food is often cited as a barrier to low-income families eating nutritious meals. A new study published in the Journal of Nutrition Education and Behavior found that with menu planning and access to stores selling items in bulk, the average daily cost for serving healthy meals to a family of four was $25 in 2010. This cost was consistent with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, low-income cost of food meal plan, but higher than the cost USDA thrifty food plan. The thrifty food plan is the meal plan used by the USDA to determine food assistance benefits. But,
you know, this was interesting. Did you want to say anything more about it?
No, you tell me.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that a lot of the argument for why people in lower income communities can't get good food is because they're in what's called a food desert.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, we've been seeing a lot of Dollar Tree stores popping up, and those probably don't carry fresh produce. It's generally all frozen, pre-packaged processed foods. So I don't know. I guess I want to see more research done. It's like, on one hand, yes, maybe you can eat healthy.
With the proper access.
Yeah. Well, we need to make sure that we have not food deserts and, you know, local produce, and then also, you know, trying to figure out creative ways to budget. It's difficult.
It is difficult, but it is possible.
Well,
eating out is not the solution. Do not eat out.
The problem, though, this study doesn't really account for time either.
Yeah.
So that's cooking the other argument. Time. Yeah. So working families, especially both parents are working. Maybe they don't have time to prepare a meal, but
yeah.
There is hope.
There's hope. HealthyTalkShow.com/support. We're going to show you how to make good food.
Yeah.
Good food.
And we do it pretty cheaply.
Yeah, we do. Actually,
for the most part.
We eat pretty, yeah. Well, we don't eat a lot of. CNN, fish fraud. What's on the menu often isn't what's on your plate. If you splurge on the sea bass or snapper, you may not always be getting what you pay for, even if it's the fanciest restaurants or upscaliest fish markets. Yeah. What do you think? We have a video.
Yeah, let's watch the video.
Let's check it out.
The U.S. is now the second largest consumer of seafood worldwide, right after China. The Centers for Disease Control says about 20% of adults are eating fish at least twice a week. But choosing your fish doesn't always mean getting what you're after. Meg Oliver has that story.
Whoa. Fish mislabeling. Let's go.
Just knowing that the seafood we're getting is fresh and coming from a country that has shipped it in a timely manner and markets it and is honest with their marketing practices.
Those practices have come under fire around the globe with rampant fraud in all stages of the seafood industry. One study of retailers found seafood like grouper, cod, and snapper may be mislabeled up to 87% of the time.
87% of the time?
Jeez.
Out for less desirable and cheaper varieties. For example, only 7 of the 120 samples of red snapper were actually red snapper.
It's a very big problem, and the issue is that once it's prepared, there's really no way to to check it other than DNA testing, which a lot of companies are now doing.
Yeah, who's going to do that?
Yeah.
Fish fraud.
I wish they had said what the cheaper fish were, but...
Yeah, what exactly they are. Here's something about organic fish, though. It's good. It's good for you. Right?
90% of the seafood consumed in the U.S. is imported, and less than 1% is tested by the government.
Is it better to buy organic seafood?
Not really. In this country, there's no legal standard for organic for seafood.
No legal standard?
No. When they did the organic standards for meat and poultry and chicken, they excluded seafood. So when you see organic on seafood, it's not a legally enforceable standard, so they can put that on just about anything.
Larry Olmsted is the author of Real Food, Fake Food. He spent years researching the unregulated food industry, calling fish the most frequently faked food Americans buy.
I believe that.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, I've had some really bad sushi. You can tell the differences in quality.
Yeah. Comment in the chat, fish and chip shop I used to work at sold haddock as cod.
Interesting.
I'm not familiar with
haddock. I'm not familiar with haddock either. I know what cod, well, maybe I know what haddock is. Maybe, yeah, I don't know what cod is.
Maybe we haven't had
maybe I've never had cod before. Is this dangerous, though? Or how is this dangerous? What do you think? See, is this dangerous?
The bottom line is a lot of the fish that we eat, we don't know where it came from or how it was produced at all.
So how dangerous is this?
I think it's pretty dangerous. There's tens of millions of people that get sick from foodborne illness every year that the CDC cannot explain.
If they don't clean it up and we don't see more regulations, what could happen in the future?
The destructions of the ocean, and it's the single biggest source of protein in the world. We have a burgeoning global population. Since the history of mankind, having enough food to eat has been the number one priority of people. So it's really important that we take care of the oceans.
Agree with that.
Yeah.
Got to take care of the oceans.
If we want to eat sustainably, we would like to know what we're eating. So
yeah,
we can eat local. I'm kind of hungry after all those fish pics.
Well, are you ready to get unhungry?
Okay.
Next web. The UK government is looking to criminalize unsolicited dick pics. Say what?
What?
What? Although apps like Tinder set out to make dating easier by putting hundreds of options only a swipe away, they also carry a greater risk of non-consensual interactions and new opportunities for perpetrators to target and abuse victims. Whether it's an abusive message waiting in your inbox or an unsolicited airdrop from a complete stranger, surprise dick pics are an all-too-common form of sexual harassment. But yesterday it was announced in the Home Office is taking preliminary steps towards criminalizing online flashing and its violence against women and girls, VAWG, VOG, presumably. Report, the Home Office proposed 10 commitments it believes will protect women and girls in the UK, and it's backed by more than 100 million in euros in funding over the next 5 years. One of the commitments promised will be to explore issues of online flashing and consider options for next steps. Currently, it's unknown what these next steps will entail, but the government has promised to work with online dating services to raise awareness of VOG at an earlier stage of the relationship. Wow, that's a lot. That's a lot for the eggplant.
I just don't get how they're going to enforce this.
Yeah.
And then, so then it would, I feel like they would have to track everyone's online identity somehow, which...
Yeah.
I mean, that's just not
comment from the possible chat. Good thing I don't live in the UK. I know. You send me pics all the time. Well, I don't understand it. It's weird. You got to stop. Calm down with those.
Don't
need to see that every day. Well, I think we are done with our headlines. Now we can have some fun.
Some fun?
Yep.
Talk about the history of daylight savings time.
Yep.
Why we're so tired.
I'm Business Insider is the first video. Oh, it's Global News. Why we change our clocks? My clips went out of order for some reason. Tang's in my shot. It's okay. I'm cool with it. I don't mind. All right. Well, daylight savings time. I guess we can get into that. What do you think? How you want to approach this? We have clips.
Yeah, let's play the intro.
Clips. Got it.
We move our clocks ahead 1 hour in March to inject more sunlight into the evenings. Simple enough. When we do this, we also lose an hour of sleep. This is what we call daylight saving time, and the rest of the year we label as standard time. The primary rationale for the time change, which took hold more than 100 years ago, was to conserve energy, which in turn...
Oops, I had bad editing. My fault. Oh. But we've all heard the argument about the consume energy. But no, yeah. I can keep going. I got more clips. Is he, if he's being a little...
I don't know what he's doing.
If he's, yeah. he's going to start being a pest, we can just kick him out. All right. It's all right. And lock up the door.
He's okay.
All right. I got another clip.
Yeah.
What few people know is that daylight saving time was actually first established in a small town in Canada. The city, now known as Thunder Bay, Ontario, was the first place in the world to turn back the clock in 1908. Now, daylight saving time is used by more than a billion people in over 70 countries around the world. The farther away you go from the equator, the more likely daylight saving time is implemented.
There you go. Daylight savings time. Learning the history.
So is it effective?
Does it save energy?
There is little evidence that daylight saving time actually saves energy. In fact, it's difficult to study because technology is evolving so fast. Think coal burning, the magnificent air conditioner, the switch from tungsten light bulbs to LEDs. And as technology keeps getting better and better, we're filled with a world of distractions. The bottom line, there are thousands of studies that provide contradictory findings. Some conclude that daylight saving time saves electricity, while others conclude it actually costs more. But one thing they agree on is the effect size of energy consumption. It's either 1% more expensive or 1% less expensive, which is the equivalent to either $13 saved or $13 spent a year for one U.S. household.
And that's true.
Yeah.
There's no definitive any. It's one way or the other. It's frustrating.
It's also really hard to do research, though, because technology's changing and then our activities become more technology-centric and we have more devices.
Yep. But is it worth it health-wise?
Oops. Let's see.
Let's see.
Now the question becomes, is the hassle of twiddling the clocks twice a year really worth it?
From a purely health perspective, you're probably better off not having these shifts.
Dr. Andrew Lim, a neurologist who's focused a lot of his research on sleep disorders, says the change affects your sleep-wake cycle. And according to one U.S. study, switching over to daylight saving time and losing 1 hour of sleep raised the risk of having a heart attack the following Monday by 25% compared to other Mondays during the year. Essentially, the shifts are disrupting your circadian clock. Here's what that means.
So the circadian clock is the body's internal biological clock. It's what allows the body to stay synchronized to the day-night cycle. And it actually controls a whole host of physiological functions in pretty much every organ in the body.
So it isn't so much your own biological clock that is shifting, but it's the world around you.
And what happens is the shift in the biological clock actually lags a little bit. It's almost like a form of jet lag.
Is it worth it financially?
Let's see.
Okay, so not worth it from a health perspective, but what effect would it have on the economy?
On average, when you're looking at the U.S., the single day loss from this effect amounts to about $30 billion on average. So it's economically consequential.
Lisa Kramer, a professor of finance at the University of Toronto, studied the effects changing the clocks had on the stock market in Canada, the U.S., the U.K., and Germany. And what she found is that the following Monday, although there is typically a dip in the stock market, the negative returns are 2 to 5 times larger in magnitude following daylight saving time.
Okay. I don't know how you can gauge that, but it's cool. Yeah. We had to throw it in there just because it was in the video.
It's pretty interesting.
We have the case against daylight savings time, but maybe you want to get into your research first.
Yeah, well, I just have the research that kind of talks about... backs up what the doctor was saying, that it does kind of increase the risk of heart attacks.
Yeah, all kinds of health issues, but a lot of mental health, depression.
Yeah. It says that there's a small increase of acute myocardial infarction, aka a heart attack, in particular after the spring shift. So that's the one that we just went to where we kind of lost an hour. And especially in male subjects, probably in relationship to sleep deprivation and circadian misalignment impacting cardiovascular health through increases in sympathetic tone and catecholamine levels.
Crap.
So, you know, essentially your whole circadian system is responsible for regulating different hormones and all these different signalings, and it causes stress. We also see, so there's another article that says... fatal accidents following changes in daylight savings times, the American experience, they found there was a small increase. So it says they went from an average of 78.2 accidents to an average of 83.5 on the day after the shift.
That is an increase.
So a small increase. They said they noticed it, that, you know, maybe there is a correlation between the lack of sleep. Maybe it's darker too, more distracted drivers, tired drivers.
What does the chat room think? Just out of curiosity. We have another video. We have some more things to show about daylight savings. We have the case against daylight savings from Business Insider.
Yeah. Plus what we were talking about, the loss of productivity. There's probably increases of what they call internet loafing. So that's the Monday after daylight savings time. So tomorrow, everyone's going to be surfing on the internet, wasting time.
At work?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm not going to be at work tomorrow.
And because they're tired, and so you waste more time on the internet.
That makes sense. Yeah, that's, and it does. I see it affect people. It affects a lot of people that I know. It's, why do we do it? I don't know. Here's the case against it, if you guys are interested. Let me pull up this video. Business Insider.
War. It wasn't until 1966, history, when the Uniform Time Act was passed, that the U.S. began observing daylight saving time from spring to fall annually. It's because of the 2005 Energy Policy Act that daylight saving now begins during the second weekend of March and ends during the first weekend of November every year. But studies have found that adjusting our clocks doesn't really save us anything on energy use. What we save on lighting is negated by increased use of heat and air conditioning. When it's light out longer, we also tend to drive more, which means using more gas. Daylight saving extensions haven't been driven by energy costs. They've been driven by retailers who want to give consumers more daylight to shop, eat out, and play golf.
Ooh, very interesting.
Yeah.
And while that isn't necessarily a bad thing, there are costs associated with losing an hour every March.
So it's more to keep people shopping and spending money?
Potentially. I can see that.
Yeah.
Or light in the evening, so people want to do more things.
That's why we need nuclear energy in the chat. I agree with you 100%. Last from the video, health effects and conclusion.
Studies have found that on the Monday after springing ahead, we see a spike in car accidents and heart attacks and a lull in productivity.
Yeah.
One study estimated that the time shift cost the U.S. over $430 million in lost productivity. And following daylight saving time doesn't optimally align daylight hours with normal hours of human activity. It actually makes it worse. With daylight saving time, the entire continental U.S. has a reasonable sunset time for a majority of the year. But many places only see reasonable sunrise times for less than half of the year. If we were to abolish daylight saving time, we would still have roughly the same number of days with acceptable sunsets. Plus, we'd have way more days with appropriate sunrise times. So while getting rid of daylight saving time might mean a little less time spent on the links in the summer, it could also mean a few less car accidents and a lot more pleasant mornings.
Yeah. I'll take it.
Yeah, and not all states observe daylight savings times.
I think two don't.
Yeah, Hawaii and Arizona. Hawaii because they're close to the equator, so
yep,
they don't really feel the need. Arizona, it's because it's really hot in Arizona, so they don't want longer daylight hours.
Yeah.
they're going to be indoors napping.
Well, that was fun. This was a very long episode.
Yeah.
Hour and 30, about. Trim off about 10 for us forgetting that we were recording for 10 minutes, so about hour 20.
Oh, did you have that video about the biphasic sleep?
No, I clipped it, remember?
Oh yeah. I couldn't remember. Sorry.
We axed it. We had a video about biphasic sleep, or what would they call it, second sleep?
Yeah, we can at least talk about second sleep.
The history. We actually been doing it this weekend somehow, inadvertently. We didn't mean to. But the story goes that during the times without electricity, during the colonial days, families on farms and whatnot would go to sleep at 8 o'clock or 7 or whenever it got dark, they'd go to sleep. They'd wake up around 1 or 2 a.m., do crafts, make babies for an hour or two, and then go back to sleep and then wake up with the sun.
Yeah.
And we've been doing that for some reason because the dumb dogs wake us up. So we've been doing that for the past couple of days. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting.
We add another step to it that I'm not going to talk about on the podcast. If you want to know, hit me up after the show. But there is another step to it that makes second sleep a lot better.
Yeah,
helps you fall asleep back into second sleep a lot faster.
Yeah.
It's really nice.
So it's a debate that's been going on whether we should continue to do daylight.
We should get rid of it.
Yeah.
100%. Stop moving the clocks. Give me a time and let's just stick to that time, please.
True. Plus it makes international time crazy
because
different countries observe daylight saving times at different start times.
Why?
And
crazy. And groundhogs. Why do we have groundhogs? Oh, man. All right. Well, thanks for tuning in. If you found value and useful information in this show, my script is not visible. Please support the show by emailing us, ask@healthytalkshow.com. Leave us a voicemail, 509-878-3229, and support us financially, healthytalkshow.com/support. We'd love to hear from you. Love and light. Closing out today's episode, the last blockbuster in the world. It's in Oregon. It's sad to see it go. Bye, Blockbuster. I'll miss you. Bye-bye.
Hold strong, Blockbuster.
Hold strong. Pretty cool. They really did screw a lot of people over. These bastards. All right, cool.
Love and light.
Love and light.